The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
I'm joined by Jack Horgan-Jones, him from the Irish Times, where he is political reporter, and Barbara Scully, broadcaster and writer. Guys, can you explain the whole Oasis thing to me? Because in my mind, you know, the Verve, Blur, Oasis, that sort of leftover Primal Scream thing from the 90s, it was grand at the time. What is going on?
You're such an old man, do you know that? And you're younger than I am.
Like, everybody's like, this is, you know, Oasis. It's a once-in-a-lifetime chance to see the band of my... It's Oasis, lads.
I must say, I would be a fan of Oasis. I love their music. And I would be delighted to be in Croke Park to see them, except that you guys dragged me in here and away from my laptop and my phone.
Barbara. You wouldn't have got us anyway.
Yeah. Well, you see, that's the problem I have. I think that kind of, I would love to go to Oasis, and if somebody wants to provide me with tickets, I'll happily go along, and I would very much enjoy it, I'm sure. But I actually have a big problem with this kind of, your stress level would be out the window trying to get tickets this morning. It would be, and I'm just not willing to do that anymore.
The appeal is the fame thing, though. Your analysis there is entirely kind of musical, you know, and there probably is a musical defense of Oasis being better than those bands that you kind of group them in
there
with.
Is, there is.
And I would.
Prime are pretty good.
But it's the fame, it's the brothers, it's the split, it's the acrimony, it's the fact that they summed up the kind of 90s celebrity and Britpop in a way that all those other bands didn't. And that's why people are particularly interested. The thing that I think is most interesting this morning is looking at the various WhatsApp groups that I'm in. There's a real divide between parents of young children and those who don't have young children. Those who don't have young children are giving out about having to be up so early on a Saturday. They're up before 8 to be in the queue, and they also have the excess income to buy the tickets. So that's the dividing line.
There was something nice, though, about back in the day, human suffering could guarantee your capacity to get a ticket.
Yes.
If you were willing to sleep on Grafton Street for 36 hours, you would be at the top of the queue. You had the capacity to control this. I think the notion of being in a queue and just turfed out and told good luck, goodbye, I would take me weeks to come down from the fury of that.
Yeah, and it gave rise to great moments as well. What's the name of the lead singer of the Libertines, Pete Doherty? Did you ever see the footage of him in the 90s queuing for Oasis tickets?
Was he?
Yeah, and talking about Liam and Noel and stuff like that. And so there you go. Endorsed by Pete Doherty.
Do you know what I'm more excited about?
Endorser of queuing for tickets as well.
Now that the lads in Oasis, the brothers, have, you know, got back together again, I'm just waiting for news from the palace in London.
That Harry and William are pals once
that's
more.
That's going to be the next thing, yeah.
And they're going on tour.
And they're going on tour. They're going to do a visit together.
Believe it or not, there is other stuff in the news which we should look at. There's
none of which is cheerful.
A lot of it is interesting, though. I mean, the Examiner has an interesting breakdown on the fertility rates in Ireland and across the world. And the degree to which they're dropping off a cliff is extraordinary in what is referred to as the developed world. Irish Times front page, homelessness reaches new record high. Jack, this is your paper. This is now, what, 4 years in, 5 years into this crisis that we are told is being, the nettle is long since been grasped, and we are hitting our highest numbers of people in emergency accommodation ever.
Yes. And here's a really interesting statistic that isn't actually on the front page. So 14,429, new record high, as you say, adults and children in homeless accommodation. At the tail end of the last government, around this point in the political cycle, Owen Murphy, the then housing minister, faced a notion of no confidence in December of 2019, which he won, but not by a massive margin, which was kind of in the run-in to the collapse of the last government. And the homelessness figures at that stage were 10,514, so they're 4,000 higher. What I can't quite grasp, and what I don't think anyone can grasp, is that while housing is the soft underbelly of this government and voters are very concerned about it, you haven't seen quite the same attendant pressure on the current Minister for Housing, Dara Brine. So I think that that's a political phenomenon that I haven't really wrapped my head around yet, and it's one to really watch how it tracks out across the next parts of the political cycle leading up to the general election. But like, while these monthly releases of figures became an absolute noose around the neck, ultimately, of Owen Murphy, it hasn't been the case for Dara Brine quite just yet.
Can you explain that, Barbara? Because it was political poison at one point. At this stage, is it simply that we are so used
to
it?
That's exactly what it is. I think you've got voter fatigue over this. Yes. We have heard about it for so long, and we've now just accepted that it just doesn't, no matter what's happening, it just does, it gets worse rather than getting better. And I mean,
there's
it is
a sense
shocking.
Of defeatedness, isn't there?
There like, is, you know, a sense of...
And a lack of faith in politics writ large to solve
exactly.
the problem.
No, I absolutely agree. And we were talking earlier, and it relates to the thing you flagged up a moment ago about the fertility yeah. rates, is that we have a generation, and I'm the mother of two daughters in their mid-20s and another daughter in her late 30s, shocking, that the generation in their 20s have now accepted that they will never be able to buy a house. That has been, they have heard that for so long now that they have kind of accepted the fact that, but sure, we'll never be able to buy a house, which is leading to the rise in the numbers of people leaving this country to
now,
go travelling.
Are you
away.
Saying that they have accepted that because that is the truth, or it is learned
no,
helplessness?
It's learned helplessness. I think they have accepted it because it's what they hear all the time.
I know, but it is.
And we have
true.
A housing crisis, and it's not true. No,
no, no, no. Sorry, I think it is true. I think I think home ownership is a available to a significantly smaller cohort of the population yeah. than has traditionally been the case in Ireland. I think that all the statistics would support that.
In perpetuity, and I think people, they will never own a
Well, I don't know about in perpetuity. It depends, I suppose, how effective the state and the government and the political system is at addressing that. But I think people intuit this and yeah. and that feeds across into the front page story and the spread in the Examiner
yeah.
about fertility and yeah. how people, women are having babies later and later in life, if at all. And it's because these attainers and signifiers of adulthood, which would tend to encourage yeah. people down the road of, right, okay, we have the marriage and the house locked down, let's start thinking about having the kids and, you know, what's the value of the estate that you're going to pass on to the kids when the inevitable occurs. Those building blocks, if you pardon the
yeah.
the pun, they're not falling into place because that thing that unlocks
yeah.
much of this home ownership is not taking place.
And on the one hand, it's kind of interesting to watch it, but on the other hand, it's so sad that we have this generation who have accepted it. And I mean, I'm always saying to my kids, don't accept that. You should be. And this generation, they don't protest, they don't give out, they leave. They leave. I just think that's a shocker, as well as the fact that, as I say, when you mentioned the figures, there are 14,429 people in emergency accommodation, 4,400 of which are children. And that is the thing that we should be really upset about.
Yeah, there's a quote on the front of the Times from a charity representative saying the notion that thousands of children are yeah. starting their school year from emergency accommodation.
Where they have no right. room to do their homework, where they're not having nutritious food because mm-hmm. they're, you know, there isn't proper cooking facilities. The ripple effects of having large numbers of children in situations like this is just appalling.
And that's older children as well, the younger yeah. children from a developmental and mobility point yeah. of view. You know, a hotel room is not a big space.
No, it's not. And I mean, you know, for anybody who lives, as I do, in the suburbs, over the last, I suppose, decade, we have seen so much building going on. There are apartment blocks going up everywhere. And I'm now at the stage where I drive around and go, investor fund, because you can look at the apartment block and the balconies all have the same furniture on them. And if you can see into the interiors, they all have the same furniture. And half the time they're still empty. The ones that have, there's been one built near me and it's people moved into it overnight. And all the balconies have children's toys on it and different furniture. And you can see plants and it's social and affordable housing. And I'm like, you know, again, it comes back to the fact that the government refused to build social and affordable housing. And I was reading something, or I was listening to something recently about student accommodation as well. We don't have enough student accommodation. And I do not understand why the government cannot take it on as they did back in the day mm-hmm. and build student accommodation and then become the landlords who rent this out forever and ever. It'll be an income stream. OK, it's a long term project. But I don't understand why we have a government who like one after the other, refused to do that.
It bleeds into other policy areas as well, just briefly. You know, I mean, there is the housing crisis. But there's also, you know, you are confronted by the reality of the early years education system in Ireland. Yeah. The costs, yeah. the governance, the regulation, the standards, the practices and so on. You know, and people are saying, how many children am I going to have? How many can I afford to have when you're yeah. looking at, you know, a baby room is £1,000 or yeah. thereabouts.
Well, you were linking this and the housing issue to the study done in the Examiner in relation to birth rates. Some of the stats in relation to fertility in Ireland are extraordinary. They've compared the 1950s through to 2021 as years in question, which the 50s were quite the booming year when it came to, or quite the booming decade for babies. But nonetheless, Ireland's births per 1,000 population have dropped by 55% since 1950. And they list a whole lot of countries in the same kind of category. Italy down by 67%, Spain down by 64%. Japan's birth rate has dropped by 78% in that period. It's an extraordinary drop. And at the same time, Jack, a lot of the figures are talking about the age at which mothers have their children increasing significantly, up from 26 years in 1985 to 31 years now.
There's a huge amount of stats. In some ways, there's too much stats in this piece, but it's worth taking the time to try and kind of digest as much of it as possible, because the trends there are remarkable, particularly when you look at the span of time from the 1950s onwards. But there are other trends, I think, that interact with this, and they're not always negative. You know, in the 1950s, women were often seen as kind of walking incubators and housewives, and some of the trends that, you know, mean that people, that women are having children later in life, are to do with the fact that, like, you know, women are more likely to go to university now. They're more likely to be and remain in the workforce now. And these are positive things that reformers campaigned for over... Well, there's certainly things that campaigners sought over a long period of time. And I think certainly that almost all women would welcome the opportunity to participate.
He says nervously, looking across the studio.
No, I'm not nervous. No, I'm not nervous about that. No,
except for the owl and opposite him.
perhaps not everyone wants to feel obligated to be in the workforce, male or female. But certainly, I don't think anyone can make a good faith argument against the opportunity to participate in higher education and the workforce being available to people of all genders.
No, but I do think something that I feel, again, really strongly about, because from where I sit, I mean, my youngest child was born in 2000. And I can remember having two small children and a grumpy teenager and both of us with full-time jobs. And I can remember how horrendous that was. And the fact that we both woke up one day and said, we are both working our behinds off and we are not by any means wealthy or even like comfortable. And we made the decision, and we could make the decision because my husband is self-employed, that I would step back from the workforce and become, in inverted commas, a housewife. And I was angry about that in one sense, but in another sense, I know that our quality of life improved like exponentially as soon as one of us stayed at home to cook meals and have meals at the right time, and that we could reduce some of our childcare costs, a lot of our childcare costs. So, you know, I think that feminism has rushed ahead in trying to make women equal, which we're still not there yet. And I totally support that. But I think at the same time, we've tried to make women equal in a world that was designed by men for men who had women at home doing all the stuff. And most women that I know, younger women, I'm not talking about women my age, younger women are still pulling the double shift. In other words, they're still, you know, they have to go out to work because they need to have two incomes in order to support the mortgage and the childcare and all the rest of it. But there's nobody picking, like, they still have to do all the stuff that's involved in running a home and looking after children. And the large burden of that still falls to women. So,
really, you know, you don't think men contribute 50-50?
I think in general, no. No, I know there's some men, and you look hurt.
Hashtag not all men.
Yeah, hashtag not all men. Yeah, exactly. But I still think the burden, and I think a lot of, I mean, I can remember the day I made the decision to walk away from a job to retire, to become, I didn't know what I was going to become, a housewife, a domestic goddess or whatever. The amount of women I met who said this quietly to me, I wish I could do that. I think if you ask a lot more women than are willing to maybe say out loud, would say, I would love to take 5 years, 10 years, 3 years off to be at home and look after my children when they're small.
And do you think that's a contributing factor to what we're seeing in terms of the birth rates?
Yeah, I think it's a contributing factor to everything. I think our lives have become so crazy. And this is the point I was trying to make, was that I can see now with my 37-year-old, who, albeit she lives in Perth in Western Australia, she's two small kids, she works full time. I know how knackered she is all the time. And nothing has changed. Nothing has improved. And I think until we value the work involved in care, whether it's caring for your children at home or caring for older people or caring for whoever needs care, we don't value that. And until we put a value on that, I think this problem isn't going to go away.
There can be a disconnect as well between the kind of the stated policy intent of governments looking to kind of encourage this blended approach for mothers, but also for fathers in that first few years of having young children. So, for example, this government brought in extended parents' leave. There's now three forms of parents' leave. There's parents' leave, there's paternity leave, and parental leave. and they extended the one from 7 to 9 weeks this year. And that's a really welcome step and will enable, I think, both mothers and fathers to have that blended approach in the first 2 to 5 years of a kid's life. But the gimme is that it's only on social welfare rates. So really it's down to whether your employer is willing to make your and that's a probably pretty small percentage
There's
of employers.
There's also a cultural issue with some of those leaves as well in terms of men actually taking them. If you look at the Eurostat's figures on the gender pay gap, a lot of the gender pay gap is that women take the leaves whereas men don't, even though they are available to them.
Yeah.
And trying to convince men to say leave should be a norm. Go away, go home. And
it can be a little bit. It can be a little bit sly sometimes as well. Like I was in a really lucky position where I was able to take a month's parents' leave earlier on this year. And when I came back, one person did say to me, "How was the holiday?" Yeah, like which is not a million miles from how was the golf course and the parents' leave. You know.
Yeah, yeah. I remember that doing 10 years being at home as a. You know, there isn't even a proper title for parents who choose to stay at home. And I remember being at social events and somebody turning around and saying, "And what do you do, Barbara?" And it used to be the question. I hate it because I couldn't describe it. And I knew if I tried to, it just made me seem like I was on a permanent holiday watching daytime telly all day. Mm. Again, it goes back to the fact that we don't value the work involved.
One final stat just before we move off. That is just an intriguing one. They also break down the births per women. So they talked about the age at which women are having babies. The difference from 1950 to the 2020s. The average number of births per woman in Ireland in 1950 was 5. Right. The average now 2.3. So women are having half as many.
But we're still ahead, I think, of a lot of other countries in the world. We still tend to have more children here than other countries.
We're kind of mid-table, apparently.
Yeah.
We're having them later, but we're having more of them when we get around to it.
Can I also just make one other point that's related, not in that piece, for women? The older you have your last child, the longer you live.
That's all.
Yep. Women who had their last child over 33 doubled their chance of living to 95. There you go.
What you would have to take out of that sample. What might be the other influences as to why that would be the case? Very interesting. All right. Before we wrap up, there is Enoch Burke is back in the news because they're attempting to arrest him, but he wasn't there because he had, according to his father, gone to school. This being the school that dismissed him some time ago, but he's standing outside it. I suggested that we might discuss this, and the look of just horror and disappointment on Jack's face means that we're going to talk about U.S. politics. Kamala Harris did her first big interview, CNN. The Republicans saying it was a disaster, Democrats saying it was great, and none of the polls seem to have moved.
Yeah, it was somewhere in between. Both Harris and Trump were down in Georgia this week, Jimmy Carter country.
Who is desperately trying to stay alive to vote for Kamala Harris.
I'd forgotten he was still alive. I was marvelling this morning at his longevity. He must have had children very late in life. Yeah. He's 99. He's 99. So
history is treating Jimmy Carter very well.
It is.
Yeah, well, this is it. Like, I mean, people kind of... people are perhaps tacking back towards politicians in the Jimmy Carter mold, the more kind of folksy... less electrifying, maybe, and
human beings,
decent,
kind of
fundamentally decent individuals. And I think Micheál Martin channels a bit
and
of that energy. And a prophesizing
Christian of some commitment.
But to bring full circle back to 2024's general election in the States, I mean, I think that Kamala Harris and her running mate kind of channel some of that energy, you know, that kind of folksy, well-intentioned, they almost are kind of like embarrassing high school parents, you know, like they have this kind of easy, you know, bumbling charm to them in some ways. And I think that that's kind of the political energy that is coalescing around them from people who are a little bit, more than a little bit, perhaps, unsettled by the kind of what one of the papers has today is this kind of dark, fissile energy around Donald Trump, you know. And I think perhaps that's one of the things about her political brand that has led into what we've seen in the polls, which is a narrowing, certainly, where Trump was clearly leading and had an advantage in swing states over Biden to where it's kind of neck and neck in some and where she's creeping ahead in others. And Georgia is a really good example of that. I mean, there was a Bloomberg poll during the week. There, I jotted down the results, but I now can't read my own handwriting. Where she was, you know, there it is, 2%. She's up 2% in Georgia, which is a state that that Biden held by 0.2% in 2020. So she's 2% in August. She's 2% ahead of Trump, and it was flat in July. So this is perhaps the kind of Harris effect, you know, the Kamala Harris.
One thing
effect
that I find interesting in some of the polls is when you begin to drill down, it does point to how still racially divided America is. Because if it was just white America that was voting, Donald Trump would be home and hosed.
And if it was just men.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it is only Hispanic voters and black and voters that are counteracting. And you're right, college-educated suburban women that are counteracting that. But particularly among whites, particularly among white men, Donald Trump, if that was the electorate in America, he's away in a hack.
Well, thank God they're multicultural. They have plenty of women and they have plenty of Hispanics. I've really very little to contribute. I just find that, all those figures make me go to sleep, so...
I've been trying to get Oasis tickets from the word go. I got in the queue after 15 minutes on one browser and I was almost 600,000 in the queue. After 30 minutes later, I got another browser and it gave me a slot at just shy of 400,000. I'm thinking of going away on holiday and seeing where I am when I get home. Another, they're not the Beatles, although they think they are. It's sad that their fans didn't experience the 60s. Real music without electronic enhancement. The variety has never been mad. By God, who was your man, George Thingy, the producer, who threw a load of...
George Martin, that's him.
He was into his little bit of electronic, and it might have been analog electronic, but it was still enhancement, wasn't it?
Yeah, and it was enhanced by all kinds of other things as well, I think, a lot of the time as well.
Do you know the really depressing thing? If I have my maths right, we are now in time to Oasis forming than Oasis forming is to the Beatles, or vice versa.
Oh, I hate these things. Yeah. They make you feel terribly old.
Just melts my head.
53106 or 087-1400-106 if you want to get in touch. The first will cost you 30 cents. The second one is free. A big thank you to Barbara Scully, broadcaster and author. And a thank you to Jack Horgan-Jones, political reporter with the Irish Times.
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.